Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CIO Houseview monthly live stream. Today is Thursday, March 7th, 2024. I'm Anthony Pastore, and I'm sitting here in our New York City studios. Thank you so much for joining us today. Let me introduce the colleagues who are joining me for this conversation. Nadia Lovell, Leslie Falconio, and Kevin Dineen all are here to answer many questions and hopefully questions from you. As you know, we do like to hear from our live audience during this CIO Live webcast. So on the page you're watching this video, there's an Ask a Question button, and it's open right now to allow you to engage with us during today's discussion. So we'll open up those lines throughout the show, and we'll get to the questions a little bit later. So again, thanks, everybody. So let me start with Leslie Falconio. Leslie, always a pleasure to have you. And here's what I want to start with you. It really feels to me like a lot of investors have been sleeping on the resiliency of the U.S. economy. Clearly, it has been underappreciated, and of course, subsequently, the impact that that has had on interest rates. And you and I talk about this quite often on our various shows here. Here at CIO, we've called for a rise in interest rates in the first quarter of 24, given that we reached a little over 4.3% on the 10-year yield, which is about almost 50 basis points higher than the end of the year. So where do you see rates going from here?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Anthony, you're exactly right. I mean, the narrative, when you think about it, entering in from 2023 and 2024, it's actually quite similar. I mean, with the end of the year in 2024, with the assumption that, you know, the economy would slow, they priced in all of these Fed rate cuts. And sure enough, you know, it's early, but we're seeing this resiliency of the economy through the payroll report, through some inflation data that we've seen recently. And with that said, the market then once again shifts these cuts out, you know, makes it now about 80 basis points. We're expecting 75. And as a result, interest rates rise. So when we think about how we believe interest rates will move going forward, you know, it really depends. And I know this is, I hate to say this, but it's true. But now that we have a market that is closer to Fed guidance, it's really going to depend on how this data plays out. And obviously, tomorrow's payroll number will be a big force to see whether or not, you know, although we're expecting it to be strong, we expect it to be less strong than what we saw in January data, which was plus 355, now we're plus 200. And obviously, next week's CPI is also going to be a major indicator, because this is really where, in our opinion, and, you know, the economy is going to look and say, okay, are we, you know, higher for longer in terms of inflation, you know, even if it comes at in a consensus number of 0.3, or is it the potential of reaccelerating? Now, it's too early to really tell either way. But one thing I'm always asked is our expectation of 10-year yields over the course of the year. And we do believe that interest rates will fall in the second half. You know, we're looking for the economy to slow to about a 2.1%. We think the labor market starts to slow, although we still believe in the soft landing. Now, really what's going to drive those interest rates is now we're hearing a lot of these stories that, you know what, maybe the Fed's not going to go 75. Maybe they'll only go to 25. Maybe they're not going to go at all. And what is really important for 10-year interest rates and for yields in general is why the Fed cuts less. And what I mean by that, is it because inflation simply stays higher for longer and doesn't trend toward their 2% objective? In that case, what the market will do, it will push those cuts into 2025, but it actually might end up pushing these cuts further out, but more materially, meaning not 25 basis points each time, but 50 basis points each time. In that scenario, our 3.5% 10-year yield is well in play. However, if the Fed's not cutting because inflation is reaccelerating, right, that's a different story, because then in that situation, you do risk the potential that another hike gets priced in. And in that scenario, you're going to see a large rise in interest rates. Now, the trend after this large rise, maybe to 5%, is really going to be how risk assets perform, whether it's the equity market or fixed income, and whether or not, once again, the market starts to price in this recession scenario. But for now, our expectation is that, you know, we were going to rise in the first quarter, of course, first quarter, and we still expect in the second half of the year, you're going to see more potential growth slow, and you're going to see the economy slow overall, and we'll trend down towards that 3.5% by the end of the year.
Yeah, Leslie, and something else that you said about the CPI, we're looking for that number coming out next week, but something that we want to remind, you know, viewers is that it doesn't mean CPI isn't linear. You know, we were declining at the end of last year, and then starting the beginning of this year, we saw the consumer price index start to rise ever so slightly to up 0.3% for the last reading. So, yeah, so obviously the Fed has its work cut out for them, and we are going to be tracking every tick of all the economic data, including, as you said, tomorrow's jobs numbers. Thank you, Leslie. Let's go to Nadia for the equity side. So, Nadia, you know, it's something that was recently in the House view is the upgrade of earnings and also the targets on the S&P 500. So what do you tell our audience? What drove these factors here?
Yes, Anthony, you know, we're sort of in this bull market, and this market has come out of the gate at the start of the year with a lot of speed and momentum, and the market continues to march higher. We have a market that's not up 8% year to date. And I will put that in perspective. You know, annualized average return for the market over the last 65 years is about 10%. And we aren't even a quarter of the way through the year yet. So there's tailwinds behind this market. We're seeing better than expected economic growth. Leslie alluded to that, earnings growth as well. We have an economy that's really on pace to grow above trend. The longer term trend is close to 2%. And so if this first quarter comes in above expectations, again, above trend, that will be seven consecutive quarters of above trend GDP growth. Earnings growth is also recovering faster. Look at the fourth quarter earnings season. That handily beat expectations, you know, posted about an 8.5% EPS growth. Corporate forward guidance were largely positive. So the rally that we have seen in this market, Anthony, is somewhat fundamentally justified. It's despite the fact that we've seen this backup in rates, the market is no longer hypersensitive to rates. Why? It's because earnings matter more, and they're finally growing again, and we're seeing it across many sectors. So all of this prompted us, Anthony, to boost our expectation for S&P earnings estimates for this year by $5. We're looking for high single-digit earnings growth year over year. We also lifted our year-end price target for the S&P 500 to 5,200. Now, Anthony, you might say to me, well, you know, that's not much upside from here, Nadia. But I will say that our upside scenario does call for 5,500. But that scenario assumes faster recovery in manufacturing. It's been in the doldrums for quite some time. And also that would assume more than the three non-recessionary disinflation driven rate cuts that we're expecting for this year. But I wouldn't get overly fixated on any sort of price target in a point in time. I think what's important here is that the ingredients are in place to support this market. As long as economic growth remains intact, the labor market is strong, and really give the consumer that confidence to continue to spend, that should help support corporate earnings and the market. I would say sitting here today, I mean, to be clear, we are constructive on the market. We think that it will grind higher. Yes, there could be some pullbacks here and there, but it's healthy for a bull market to see those sort of pullbacks. But overall, we think that this bull market will be sustained.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up to you halfway through your commentary, Nadia. We're sitting at around 5150 right now, 5155 on the S&P. So very close, as you said, to that base case number, but a lot of factors go in there. So thanks, Nadia, for kicking us off on the equity side. More questions coming your way. And as a reminder, if you want to send in a question to our panel, make sure you hit that ask a question button right there on your screen. All right, so let's stay within the studio. Kevin, always good to see you, my friend. Listen, AI, it is the biggest topic. We're talking about artificial intelligence for those that don't know the acronym, because there's also alternative investments, but we're sticking with the artificial intelligence. The market has been dominated by tech. We talk about the Magnificent Seven lifting a big portion of the S&P 500, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe you can give us, to start off, CIO's preference, your preference on tech and some of the tactical opportunities that exist.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. You're absolutely right. The narrative in the market, the narrative in the technology sector has been dominated, I think rightfully so, by AI, and we can talk about that. And we do think AI is an important part of the story, but I wouldn't get lost in just AI. I think the overall technology sector, first off, we are constructive. We have a most preferred view on the sector. And we would argue that the sector is much bigger than AI. We think there's a handful of themes and drivers out there that you can invest against inside of the technology sector. First and foremost, I think what you heard from Leslie and what you heard from Nadia was a pretty positive backdrop around economic growth. That's supportive of IT spending, because what we have to remember, We all think of IT spending as some sort of secular category that exists in a vacuum. It's not. For the most part, IT spending is corporate investment, businesses reinvesting back into their business. You need a pretty healthy profits picture and a pretty pretty good tone around corporate confidence. So what we saw was a slowdown in IT spending. We're seeing IT spending stabilize at a fairly high level, and I think we'll see that reaccelerate through the year, precisely because of the economic backdrop. Now, we're bullish on AI, but we think you can look at other parts of the technology sector. So we would focus on some of the names that are leveraged to just traditional IT spending, to that ongoing move to the cloud, to recovery in some of the key end markets like PCs, smartphones, and servers. And we think there's different ways to express that investment view.
Data really rules, doesn't it, here? I mean, yeah. It's something that we've talked about on a previous UBS trending. We talked about how important the data component is when it comes to tech and AI, and that's, you can monetize a lot of it that way.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And I think what we're seeing are software companies, particularly companies that are what's called software as a service, we're seeing those companies start to roll out some product and offerings that are based on this proprietary data that sit within their systems. And we think what's interesting about this is one, right now, I think the narrative and sort of all the gains around AI have been concentrated on the infrastructure side, sort of the picks and shovels, if I could use that analogy. And that's fair. We think that's going to continue. But ultimately, we think the market for AI services, AI solutions, is actually bigger than the infrastructure side. And we think we're actually just getting to that sort of inflection point. And we think software companies that have large pools of proprietary data, data such as email, data about your customers, data about your operations, data about your employees, data about your financials, data about your cybersecurity posture. All that data, we think, has value, and we think it can be, that value can be realized through artificial intelligence. And we think software as a services companies are uniquely positioned to drive that.
Right. What a fascinating way to transition business on the software side from one, you buy one disk at a computer store and put it in your computer forever, or you pay a monthly, annual, biannual fee, right, something like that. Fascinating on those SaaS companies. Following up on that, Kevin, though, of course, we can't talk about technology or AI without the unsung heroes being the semiconductors, which always get like sort of pushed to the side. But they are a massive component, not only for a device itself, but for the investment side. So what's going on in the semi space?
Right. So we've seen a lot of gains in semiconductor names that are leveraged to AI. And what we would say is, I think you used a phrase earlier in the conversation, investors fell asleep on the resilience of the economy. I would argue we shouldn't fall asleep on what's happening with the rest of the end markets and semis. And I referenced it earlier. We're seeing the key markets of PCs, smartphones, and servers. Mm-hmm. We're starting to see those markets bottom out and recover. And those markets combine for about 60% of total semiconductor demand. So we've put together a thematic basket called Select Semis, you know, a small curated list that have really high exposure to these end markets. Because when those end markets do better, semiconductor revenues increase. When semiconductor revenues increase, you typically see even faster gains in earnings. And we don't think that's fully priced into some of these names that are leveraged to those end markets.
Great. Thank you, Kevin. Thanks. Nadia, let me transition back to you for a moment. Because while we continue to like tech stocks for the reasons that Kevin mentioned and more, there has been a lot of concern, I would say, around the concentration of the equity market, with performance being driven by just a handful of names. We talked about the Magnificent Seven already, and it's, you know, there's now the S&P 493, because you take those seven away from the 500. That's what everybody's talking about. So do you expect the rally to broaden out from these Magnificent Seven names, and where do you see the best opportunities if that does happen?
Yes, Anthony, you know, and I would argue, in fact, that the rally has been broadened out. We're seeing evidence of that, and we expect that to continue to do so. You know, let me put some numbers around that. You know, there is already wide dispersions among the Magnificent Seven. If you look at, three of those names are actually down year to date. So that collective performance dominance that we saw last year from these stocks are starting to fade, and there's now bifurcation. And then when you look at broadly across the S&P, actually you're now seeing 40% of the S&P 500 stocks are now outperforming the index year to date. Let's compare that to last year. Last year, it was less than 30%. And then you also have nearly 30% of S&P 500 stocks that are within 5% of their all-time high. I mean, even this morning, I was looking across some of the sectors, and you have a number of stocks today that are hitting all-time highs, and they're across several sectors. So that's quite encouraging, Anthony. And then from a sector standpoint, it's not just tech, and it's just not just tech-enabled sectors that are performing well year-to-date. I mean, you have 9 of the 11 sectors that are up. With strong performance, you're seeing it across healthcare and even the cyclically tilted financials and industrials. And then from a market cap standpoint, I mean, look at small cap. Yes, it's lagged year to date, but more recently, over the last week or month, it's outperforming large cap. In fact, I mean, small cap is up 7% over the last month, and that's more than twice the S&P 500. So we would argue that the market breadth has improved, it is improving, and if economic growth continues to hold in there, which we do think that it will, that broadening out will continue. And so in terms of where we see opportunities, from a sector standpoint, you heard Kevin talked about our preference for technology. We also like healthcare and industrials. All of these sectors, Anthony, do tilt somewhat towards those mega trends, those underlying currents that will help support some of these sectors. I mean, healthcare is our preferred defensive sector. It also has some growth tilt. It's not just technology that's seeing innovation. I mean, we're seeing a good amount of innovation happening in healthcare as well. I mean, look at diabetes and obesity. Look at NASH, fatty liver disease, Alzheimer's. And then on industrial, there are signs of recovery happening in manufacturing that destocking now seems to be nearing an end, and new orders are picking up. And then we have those secular trends like infrastructure and onshore and automation spending happening. And so some of our sector positioning, Anthony, is also reflected in some of our tactical equity themes. I mean, we have tactical themes around, you know, made in America, diabetes and obesity, select semis, as you heard Kevin talked about, and more recently, housing recovery. So we think that there's a lot of opportunities, and this year is shaping up to be very different from last year already. No longer is that performance just concentrated in just a handful of stocks. So we think that the broadening out is healthy, again, for the sustainability of this bull market.
Nadia, thank you. Stay with me for 1 second, because something else, I know this is probably a big question that all of you are getting, not just you, but since we have you, we just had Super Tuesday this past week. Of course, we're talking about the U.S. election in November, which feels like a long way away, but the questions are already coming in. Regardless of what happens, we're expecting, of course, this rematch between Trump and Biden in November. But how does this at all factor into your positioning right now?
You know, I would say Super Tuesday was super obvious ahead of time, right? So, I mean, today it doesn't, but it doesn't mean that it won't later this year, you know, as we get more clarity and details around potential policy. I would say I'll highlight a couple of things that we are keeping an eye on, Anthony. You know, we know that former President Trump tends to favor tariffs and has suggested a blanketed universal 10% tariffs on imports and even higher tariffs for goods coming from China. So, you know, if that does get implemented, that could have implications for multinationals who could potentially face some retaliation tariffs. Some of this also could have inflationary implications. So that's something we're closely watching. We all know we're very sensitive to inflation. And then historically, Republicans tend to favor deregulation. So that could be a positive for some of those highly regulated sectors. So think financials, think energy. Remember, under former President Trump, you know, we did see a big rally in some of the bank stocks. It could also mean less scrutiny for M&A deals. I mean, just in the last week, as we know, we've seen a large airline deal get terminated. Larger deals have had a bit of a tougher time in getting through the approval process under the current administration. And then lastly, I would say, you know, these two potential candidates, we know, have very different approaches to energy and climate changes. We know that, former President Trump could look to roll back some of those initiatives that are in the Inflation Reduction Act. You know, while today the market isn't too focused on the election, it's still quite early, but it's likely to become more in focus as we get into the second half of the year, particularly as the political rhetoric picks up and we get more details around potential policy proposal and campaign platform. So not doing anything today in terms of our sector position, but it's something we monitor, and it could be have more implications in the back half of the year.
Great, Nadia, thank you very much. Good stuff. And yeah, I know those questions are already coming in. So got one more question, and then we're going to go to some audience questions which have been coming in. Leslie, let me turn it over to you. When you're looking at positioning within fixed income, since November, we have seen certain lower credit quality sectors outperform, while we have had a most preferred to higher quality sectors. Do you think that this trend is going to reverse in the next few months? And if that is the case, what do you think the drivers of that will be?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we do. And it's interesting. When we think about a lot of the rhetoric in 2023, it was really about liquidity, right? And when you look at overall fixed income and fixed income performance, it's those that are the most liquid, the higher quality, which is actually the ones that have been lagging. And part of that reason, obviously, is because interest rates have moved higher, and they have a higher correlation to interest rates. They have a higher correlation to interest rate volatility, which has also been a headwind to performance. But, you know, in some matter, having this credit-embedded sectors like high yield and even the lower quality high yield in particular, because, by the way, triple C high yield this year has been one of the top-performing asset classes, is a positive in the sense that the capital markets remains open. It's good in the fact that future defaults might be lower. But the fact of the matter is these spreads are very, very tight. And we do think that in the second half of the year, we've always thought this, volatility will decline as we get more data, right? So we are expecting volatility to decline the second half of the year, as we are expecting interest rates to decline the second half of the year. So given the fact you have the ability to earn carry really across the board within fixed income, which we haven't seen in a decade, you know, we do like that higher quality. And we do think in the second half of the year that higher quality will start to outperform.
Leslie, thank you very much. Great way to end the prepared portion of the show. So let's go over to audience questions. And by the way, we still have a few minutes left here. So if you have a question and you haven't gotten it in yet, please send it in. Click that Ask a Question button on your screen. Nadia, the first question goes to you, and it came in right after your commentary there on the presidential election. And the question is, outside of the election, are there any other risks that you're keeping an eye on to equity markets this year?
Yes, I mean, monetary policy, of course, it's something that we are closely monitoring. As you heard us talk about earlier, we do expect 3 rate cuts this year, but there's been more and more conversation about the potential for no rate cuts this year and what that could do to the market. Of course, the market isn't priced for that. So that could have implication for companies who have, you know, floating rate debt, who might be holding on. That could be a headwind to consumer spending if rates remain too restrictive for too long. So that's a potential risk to the market. We do think that the Fed is in the position to cut later this year. We continue to hear that from Chairman Powell and even some of the more hawkish tilted governors. The other one is obvious, I think. It's sort of like the labor market. If we see any sort of meaningful slowdown in the labor market, we know that consumer propensity to spend is really connected to their security in the labor market. Right now, there doesn't seem to be any real signs that we're going to see any sort of meaningful slowdown in the labor market. We'll see on Friday when we get the payroll numbers. But I think that those are the two key risks to markets. Outside of sort of any sort of black swan event in terms of geopolitical, I think realistically the key risk to markets will be a Fed that remains on hold for too long and any sort of meaningful slowdown in growth.
Great, Nadia, thank you. Kevin, let me bring it back into the studio. One of the questions that came in piggybacking off of your AI commentary is talking about the beneficiaries of AI. So what are they and where do they stand right now?
Yeah, look, I think at a first approximation, it's clearly some of the companies that provide semiconductors that these models run on. I think you have to think beyond that, right? We talked about software as a services companies. We talked about the importance of data. You know, I think there's a broader conversation about sort of this whole entire technology stack, so to speak, of AI, everything from the infrastructure of which semis are a part of, to the models, to the services and applications. You can wrap cybersecurity around that. You can think about, you know, the IT consulting companies that are going to have a lot of work to do to help get enterprises ready to embrace AI, because it's not just an IT change. It sometimes is an entire strategy shift where a lot of IT companies, a lot of consultants will actually get to work on. So we think there's a broad swath, and we think you can think about this as a continuum that starts at the bottom with all of that infrastructure and then rises all the way up through the applications, the services, and the security.
Right. Yeah, so many layers to the exactly. To the tech and AI story. Kevin, thank you. Let me see. Leslie, we've got a question here that I'll actually punt over to you talking about mortgage rates. I think certainly anybody who is trying to get a mortgage or looking to buy a home, they're looking at these rates. Now, they're down off the highs. Today, when I checked, it was about 7.18% average for a 30-year mortgage in the U.S. What are the expectations for mortgage rates as we look towards the rest of this year?
Yeah, you know, I get that question a lot because people have a tendency just to look at the change in the 10-year Treasury yield and then open the paper and say, why isn't my mortgage rate down? But there's other variables that obviously impact the absolute level of mortgage rates, and one of them being the spread of agency mortgage-backed securities. So as you know, and as people know that who read our research, that we have a most preferred in agency MBS. And here's a classic case in point, Anthony, about what you and I were discussing earlier, is that how has higher quality underperformed? And agency MBS is a classic to this. Now, this asset class is AAA, it's government guaranteed, but however, it's really underperformed this year because it's very susceptible to interest rate volatility and large rise in interest rates. And one of the reasons why it's one of our most preferred sector is that, you know, investors have the ability to pick up 45 basis points in a AAA asset class versus a BBB IG corporate. And again, MBS, no credit risk. However, because that spread is so wide, right, given where compared to where the 10-year Treasury yield is, mortgage rates have stayed elevated, even when interest rates have dropped. So when I think about the path going into the second half of the year, there's two variables that I'm looking at, which is one of the reasons why I think that mortgage rates will head lower. Number one, we believe interest rates are going to go lower to around that, say, 3.5 level. And two, really more importantly, is it is our view that because volatility will decline in the second half of the year and the economy will slow, not a hard landing, but the economy will slow, that up in quality, that higher quality sectors are really going to outperform, particularly in the mortgage-backed security side. So therefore, the spread's going to compress. So I have a lower tenure yield and a lower spread, and therefore the mortgage rate will probably end lower. Now, whether or not it's a 6 or 5.75 is yet to be seen, but it's, in our opinion, it's going to be lower where it is today.
Right. I think people are crossing their fingers they could see that 5.75 again. But thanks, Leslie. Appreciate that. Looks like we have time for one more audience question. Nadia, I will give this one to you, asking about small cap opportunities. As we know, and I'm adding this to the pile, CIO has a preference on small caps. So the question is, how important are lower rates to that call on small caps, the preference from CIO?
Yeah, I think that's a great question and an important one. You know, Anthony, of course, lower rates is a factor and a potential catalyst, but it's not the only one. You know, as we can see in the recent performance, small cap has revived itself again in the last few weeks, as I noted earlier, that despite the fact that you've seen a potential headwind from the repricing in the rates market that Leslie talked about, with bond yields moving higher and the Fed cuts being removed. Remember, at the start of the year, the market was pricing in 6 to 7 cuts, and today it's more like 3 to 4. The Russell 2000 is up on a year, and that's really thanks to some of the strong performance that we've seen over the last month, and we expect that performance to continue to improve. I think what's important, you know, credit lending conditions are becoming less severe. We did see that in the most recent senior loan officer survey and showing that less banks are tightening. And while, you know, the cost of capital is of course important, but the access to capital is quite important too. And those lending standards improving, capital markets are open. We're seeing both that on the debt and the equity side. We've seen a large volume of secondary offerings so far this year. So I think more important for the call is actually the economic environment. You know, small cap is more cyclically exposed, particularly to manufacturing. And so we continue to believe that, you know, ISM manufacturing could flip into expansion territory in coming months, just given the pickup that we've seen in new orders. And then, of course, there's always a possibility of M&A, tough to call, but we have already seen a pickup in that. Smaller companies tend to be target. And overall, you know, valuation isn't too demanding. So we think that small caps do offer attractive value here, and the call isn't solely dependent on rates.
Excellent. Nadia, thank you very much. And of course, thank you to our audience for sending in your questions. I'm sorry if we didn't get to yours today. We had a few more trickling in here in the last few minutes, but we will make sure to respond to you via email. So thanks again for the questions. And thank to the audience for tuning in. Thank you to my guests who are joining me today, Kevin Dineen, Nadia Lovell, and Leslie Falconio. Thank you all very much. So that's all the time we have for today's webcast, everybody, and thanks for spending the last 30 minutes here. Our next CIO Monthly live stream will be taking place on Thursday, April 4th, again at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And until then, we will continue to keep you updated with all of the latest publications through our House View suite. You've got CIO alerts, blogs, videos, podcasts, all you can imagine. You can find it all on our website, ubs.com/views. Plus, check out our brand new series, UBS Road to the Election, where we really dive deeply into the election year, impacts on investments, policy, you name it. That's every Thursday at 4:30 p.m. You can find more content at ubs.com/election watch. In the meantime, everybody, we want to wish you a wonderful day. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget to continue this conversation with your UBS financial advisor. Until next time, I'm Anthony Pastore. Have a great day, everybody. See you soon.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.